Sports Lit 101 time right now. And Bruce, you got a lot of ground to cover. I'm just going to sit back and enjoy the ride.
Yeah, it was a little different because I was thinking when we were talking to Elijah Wald on Monday, and I'll get back to that. It reminded me of a situation that happened about 35 years ago. I was in a place called the Speediest Printer in town in West Hartford, Connecticut. It was a print shop back in the days when you had print shops that did all that kind of stuff. It was run by a guy named Bill Domler, who was a folk DJ and a real fan of especially traditional folk music. And he also sold records in his store. So it was the only print shop record store that I knew anything about or that I'd ever been in. And I was there early one day, and these two young girls, 17, 18, 19 years old, walked in, and they said, "Do you have any Woody Guthrie, Cisco Houston, or Pete Seeger records?" And Bill said, "Yes, I do." And I sort of thought, well, this is interesting. So as he was showing them where they were, I said, "Where did you guys hear about those guys?" And they said, "Oh, Saturday night at the Jethro Tull concert." I said, "You were at a Jethro Tull concert and somebody mentioned something about Woody Guthrie?" "Oh, no, no, no. It wasn't the Jethro Tull guys. It was the guys from Fairport Convention. Richard Thompson was talking about, you need to watch. So we wanted to find out about him." Well, I got to thinking about how that's a young person starting with an arena rock act and working back to these American songwriters. It's also very much like what Elijah was talking about with the Rolling Stones, that there were people who discovered Robert Johnson because they found out that the Rolling Stones liked them, or because the Rolling Stones recorded songs written by Solomon Burke or people like that. So I started thinking about the way we go back, and I was thinking about how this is the slow sports season. And right now, I would say the activity I would describe as sports in its purest form that probably most Mainers are involved in has to do with either fishing or boating or something recreation that we do when it gets warm, because we think this is really hot. Though Carrie's going somewhere, they don't think this is very hot. And so I started to think about some of the great fishing books. And one of them that we'll be giving away later, and when we give away books again, is Fly Fishing Through the Midlife Crisis by Hal Raines, which is a great book. But it's also what we call creative nonfiction. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that and how that sort of informs a lot of great sports writing. We know what nonfiction is. I mean, Doris Kearns Goodwin writes a book about LBJ. It's nonfiction. It's researched. It's notated. It is, to her belief, the truth as most as she can possibly find out. But we also have another kind of nonfiction, which is very popular today, creative nonfiction. When I think about the person who really created that in terms of sports or recreation, I think it's Henry David Thoreau. I think if you look at books like A Week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers, Cape Cod, Katahdin, the North Maine Woods, Thoreau was the first person who not only went there and told us what was there, but then told us all of his reactions to it, all the things that he thought about. And I think that one of the things that we talk about in education and we talk about in society today are people that lack the skills of critical thinking. Why? Because I think a lot of people just don't spend time thinking. They spend time doing, right? They're the kid who's in the library and the librarian says, as the kid is staring up at the stack of books, "Don't you have something to do?" Well, he is doing something. He's thinking, right? And you don't have to be doing something. You don't have to be playing a video game.
That's a great point. And I'm trying to think who wrote about that. And I was just reading it recently, talking about the fact that, without sounding too much like the old geezer, if it's not too late already, that the current youngest generation, the high school people that I see, maybe even those in college, don't take time for reflection.
Exactly. And that's one of the biggest complaints we get in the English department from other departments is the kids can't write reflectively. And one of the reasons is I come into a classroom and I'm usually there early, but if I arrive 3 minutes before and everybody's in their seats, every single one of them has their phone out. Every single one of them has their phone out and their thumbs working. What Thoreau did was he believed in two that would things would seem to be polar opposites, that you didn't need to leave your backyard to learn everything there was to know about the world, and that in wildness is the preservation of the world. And when Thoreau started going out and writing, when he started writing about the places he went, he really began to develop all the kind of outdoor sports writing that we have today, because we don't want to know that it's a beautiful place. We want to know what you can catch there if you're a fisherman, or what you can do there. So what I was thinking about that, and was thinking about, and I'm not getting into the national park, national monument debate here, but Maine has a tremendous amount of public land. Maine is a place where if you are bored, you're out of your mind. then there is somewhere to go you haven't been. There is something beautiful to see, whether it's Roque Bluffs or if you haven't been to Acadia or to Baxter or out to the Western Mountains or down to the shore or into the Great Farm Belts. There is something to see, and there is so much public land and so many free places to walk and hike that I think that the next generation of really good writers along that will be people who have done that, you know, and need to do that. I know that my brother once made the point that if you want to catch really big fish, you just want to catch really big fish, go to the country clubs in southern New England and go fish in those ponds because nobody fishes there and they're huge fish. So one morning I saw some people when I was a caddy, when I was a kid, who weren't supposed to be on the golf course taking a walk with their dog. And I also remember the night that I had snuck onto the same golf course and caught a 4-pound largemouth bass in a pond, only about three times the size of the studio. So this is called Sunday Morning Poaching. This is a poem of mine that was published back in 2010, the Naugatuck Review. And this is just for people out there who don't know what to do, and this is what you might do on a walk. Sunday Morning Poaching. We pilfer a dark stroll a few minutes before six along a damped manicured fairway. Does grazing in nervous shadows, grouse exploding from the rough, poachers, non-members like us. With our ancient dog unable to detect or menace these interlopers, we have encroached from the woods near the third tee, obscured from the gaze of the hungover pro smoking his morning joint by the caddy shack. Sprinklers hiss, a mower drones, a heron glides into the shallows of the misted water hazard where I fished in moon-flung midnight for slackwater bleary-eyed bass and fertilizer-stunned bluegills. A great blue heron stalks the reedy edges of the pond for toxic frogs, and I recall the susurrous September night I cast a number 6 brown popper into the sinuous shaft of moonglow and landed a 4-pound largemouth. A scimitar reflected in the brown and green ripples of the silted pond, he arced in 3 jaw-shaking leaps, but as I had no net and no one waiting, I played him until he went slack, then hauled him onto the dew-slick grass. Unable to revive him, I slit his belly, full of dead grandchildren, a tangle of black insects and a yellow Dunlop range ball with a split lip crease imprisoned like a giant decomposing salmon egg or a child awaiting her cesarean birth. There are things to do.
I like that. What's that called, Bruce?
It's called Sunday Morning Poaching.
Nice.
It'll be in whenever you get another collection. It'll be in there. But for all of you that are thinking, well, there's not much in the world of sports right now. Yeah, football's coming. Hockey's coming October 4th. It's a little bit of a lull. So as Dennis Price might say regarding entertainment, get out and see something. I'm going to say get out and do something. Go out and see the beauty of Maine and enjoy that part of our sports and recreation.
Now, Bruce, I wanted to ask you, too. You brought up our conversation the other day as we talked about Elijah Wald's book, How the Beatles Destroyed Rock and Roll. And he made a statement that all those kids who listened to the Beatles or the Stones doing covers of old R&B artists didn't know those were covers of R&B artists. And I think I'm going to beg to differ with that a little bit. I hear what he's saying, but I do think some of those artists were exposed to a wide audience by the Beatles and the Stones.
Well, and I think especially the Rolling Stones. I think Elijah's point is that the Beatles didn't themselves spend a lot of time talking about them. But, you know, they did their interviews with Lennon about how great Chuck Berry was and the like. Yeah, I think the curious go back. This is what I've always thought. I mean, when I first discovered New Orleans music, I knew Louis Armstrong. I found Kid Ory and Buddy Bolden and all those guys by going backwards. And I think that is one of the things that music does for people is it teaches them to find the roots of things, the beginnings of things. I mean, you know, if you love what they call country music today, and I don't, I'll bet you'll love Hank Williams and Ernest Tubb even better. I believe that you'll love Loretta Lynn and Kitty Wells.
Merle Haggard
and some of those guys. I mean, I remember when I saw Merle Haggard in concert.
Lefty Frizzell.
Oh my God, Lefty Frizzell, one of the true greats. I mean, you look back at those people and you know how you can see how we get here. The fusion, everything changes. Every generation has its music. I'm not putting any generation's music down. But if you really want to know how this works, you got to know how that worked.
Yeah.
And that's what that is the part of the reflective thing that we're talking about that is so important, and it's become so hard. And you know this better than anybody because you have all this ground you have to cover in school these days to really teach that kind of reflective thing that our teachers did. They say, well, man, Bruce, think about that. I mean, think about this, and look at it in a different light. That time is gone now. It's instruction too often.
Yeah, although I will say, this move toward proficiency-based education, I believe, if it's done right, gets us back in the right direction, at least, to getting away from the memorization of content and the servitude to that content, getting us to a time when you can love learning again and knowledge, but also when you can work with young people on problem-solving skills. And the skills become more important than the actual content.
And that gets us back to Thoreau, who, when he started a school with his brother, he hated the rote memorization he'd gone through at Harvard, all the reciting and all that kind of stuff. So he and his brother, they held science class outdoors. They took kids, and they had a very popular school, and their students went on to do very well. And I think about, you know, a lot of what's new is old. And I think in education, that's, you and I see it all the time. I mean, I think that's really true.
Well, and I think, and I'm going to guess with all three of us here, that if you go back to your school days, whether it's college or high school or junior high school, whatever it might be, if you think back on your favorite teacher and your favorite class, I'm willing to bet that what you remember best from that is not content, or perhaps content, but content that wasn't part of the general curriculum, but maybe extra things that were thrown in that you only got because you had that particular teacher.
Yeah, I got reunited with my favorite teacher just a little over a year ago, a teacher I had in prep school in the 10th grade. I've dedicated every book I ever wrote to him. I had lost contact with him, but my daughter-in-law has brothers that knows how to find those things out, and lots of other things. But he, when I talked to him, I said, David, you know what you taught me was that this was all possible, that writing and all these things were possible. And he just couldn't, I says, you know, I don't remember telling you any of that stuff. And I said, no, because you just came into class every day, you were prepared, but if the whole class went in a different direction and you could see the value in it, you didn't turn us back. You let us learn. And he, David Bain, was the absolute best teacher I ever had in my life. And I had lots of great teachers.
You have a favorite teacher, Kerry?
Yeah, actually, two immediately spring to mind, both science teachers in high school. One, my freshman earth science, Nancy Burgoyne, and then my chemistry teacher, Kenneth True. And they, PVHS, the two science classrooms were sort of side by side and shared some common areas, lab space and stuff like that. And both of them would let students come in and study in the lab, do extra work in the lab. I did almost manage to blow myself up once tossing a can of phosphorus up until I realized what I was tossing up in the air and catching. I put it back on the shelf. But those two teachers were the ones that really reverberated with me.
I had a great earth science teacher too, the late Joe Perry, who just passed away recently, who was my homeroom teacher. He was amazing and had that same type of approach. I had a great sixth grade teacher, Isabel Bishop, who was the first person to say to me, you're a good writer, you need to do more of this, and you need to spend more time writing this, by the way, coming after I'd written a less than appropriate poem about a substitute teacher. That was not what she was complimenting, by the way. And then, my civics teacher in ninth grade, Paul Murphy, who made me want to become a teacher because every day he wanted to learn something new.
You know, it's funny you both mentioned earth science, because I would have added Walter Ahler, my ninth grader earth science teacher, who was just a wonderful guy. I mean, he would say, this weekend I found this rock. I was just digging around in my yard, and I found this rock, and he was so enthusiastic about it and stuff.
And those good teachers always found a way to relate their subject to real life, something that you could identify with. That's the key.
Absolutely.
Name of the game.
I look at the great teachers I had, and I had many in college and in prep school and in elementary school, and I can only think of three or four I didn't like.
Yeah.
But I really didn't like in all that time.
Yeah, and Mrs. Burgoyne also was a class advisor, so I had her not only for my first 2 years of science, but I had contact with her all the way through high school. And yeah, she was a great teacher. I think she just retired like 2 years ago. So
we have to take a little break here. When we come back, among other things, we're going to talk about next week's Best of Sports Lit 101, part of our week of specials we've put together so Kerry can go to New Orleans. All that straight ahead. It's The Pulse, WZON.